Hi, and welcome to the Enthusiasticast, the web show where we recommend one awesome book. This week, I'll be enthusiastic about Neil Gaiman's The Ocean at the End of the Lane. But first, John, we were in unanimous agreement that World War Z was one of the best of the best. The movie is now out. You've seen it. I've seen it. A sequel has been announced. And so my question really is, can Brad Pitt legitimately take a victory lap for this one? Or is it more of a Fincher's Dragon Tattoo kind of serviceable adaptation?
Well, I think he can take a victory lap. I don't know that he can take a victory lap for the adaptation aspect of it. Right? Like,
Maybe a bad choice of words. Bringing it to screen.
For bringing it to screen, he absolutely gets to take a victory lap. He gets to take a victory lap for a couple of reasons. One, and I think we'll probably get into this a little bit later. I mean, as a producer on the film, it was a troubled production. And so the fact that it made it to the screen and it made it to the screen in a form which has been popular and appears to, it's going to be profitable. They've announced a sequel, and that's usually the benchmark for profitability. Then he definitely gets to take a victory lap as a producer and as a performer in the film. I was really impressed with his performance in the film. I thought it was fantastic. I thought he really reined in. It was an understated performance where he really reined in a lot of his Brad Pitt tics, the shaking of the hands and the eating and just a lot of the stuff that I've seen him do time and again in films. And I really enjoy him as a performer. I've long said that he is a character actor who his good looks are almost a misfortune for him. Because in the sense that they could ever be considered a misfortune, but as an actor, they've pushed him into the leading role where I don't feel like that's where he's the most comfortable and the most suited. And so this was one of the first times that I've ever seen him in a lead role in a film where I felt he was doing it justice.
Oh man, I don't know if it's a spoiler or whatever, but when they're on the rooftop and he goes up to the edge of the roof.
Fantastic moment.
Yeah. And I was just like, oh, this is a Brad Pitt. This is a different kind of Brad Pitt at that moment. I was just like, oh, okay. I'm in the groove with you, like I'm picking up what you're putting down. Like I was totally with him and willing to follow him through the rest of the movie at that point.
Very much. Yeah, you're right. That is a good moment that really stands out. So I think we're in agreement then that it's a successful performance for him, and I think we both agree that it's largely a successful movie as a movie. As an adaptation, there is 0% of Max Brooks' book in the movie.
I wouldn't say zero, but yeah, they definitely like window checked most of it, right?
Yeah, which honestly, I'm almost happier about that. Because now the book is untouched for me, right? It remains as it was, a great book, a fantastic book, a book that I'll recommend to people. And but they'll say, yeah, but I saw the movie, and I can say, look, like seeing the movie is not going to inform your experience of the book at all. Seeing Despicable Me 2 is going to inform your experience of the book about as much as seeing the Brad Pitt version.
So I'm not crazy about seeing a sequel.
No. I feel like that's a bad call, and actually I feel like that diminishes the victory lap because, like, dude, you just got out of this with, like, dignity and pocketbook intact. Like, be happy with that. Walk away. This is hubris.
Well, right, and so I'm worried that they're going to go back for more and harvest whatever out of the book, and it's just going to be shameful.
Well, I went, you had recommended the Vanity Fair article, Brad's War, I think it was called.
Oh, did you read the whole thing?
I did read the whole thing.
Holy crap, eh?
What a great long read, and we'll link to it in the show notes. So many interesting things in that article, and and one of them. So it talks about the aborted third act. Well, not the aborted third act. They filmed it and then decided that it didn't work and scrapped it.
There's so many awesome bit players in that piece. Like it starts off with Damon Lindelof. Your boy, the showrunner from Lost, I guess.
I actually did a little bit of IMDb-ing on Damon Lindelof after the reading that article, not that I'm not familiar with him, because I am familiar with him, but I wanted to check a few things out, because to set it up for those people who haven't read the article. So basically what happened was that they spend about $1 million. They buy the rights from Max Brooks, and then they're like, okay, you know, get a screenwriter. So they get J. Michael Straczynski, who's a well-known screenwriter. I believe he wrote the screenplay for, I think it was called The Changeling, and it was the Angelina Jolie movie, where it was a period piece and her child goes missing. And anyway, so he has a relationship with Plan B and with some of the players. He was the creator and showrunner on Babylon 5. So he turns in a script, and nobody's really thrilled with that script. And, you know, there's some back and forth, but then they take him out of the equation. They bring in a guy, Matthew Michael Carnahan, who's done a lot of sort of geopolitical stuff like Lions for Lambs, The Kingdom, State of Play. And he does a script which everybody is pretty happy about. And he's responsible mainly for the character of Jerry, although Jerry was apparently a character in the J. Michael Straczynski script. He, you know, pushes him to the forefront and says, okay, he's the lead. And that's the point where Brad Pitt signs on, not just as a producer, but as a performer. So then they go and they make the movie, and there's a whole lot of stuff about the making of the movie. And then they get this third act that people don't feel is working, and nobody's really happy with it. And so at that point, they bring in Damon Lindelof for a meeting, and they show him the cut of the film that they have. And they're like, what are our options? What do you suggest? And I was really interested to see them bringing in Lindelof as a guy who they think can potentially fix the ending for them, because if there's anything that he's bad at, known for, it's endings. So he's one of the two main guys on Lost after J.J. Abrams left. Many people really unhappy with the ending of Lost, right? And then his other big work is Cowboys and Aliens, a movie that nobody was really happy about.
It was abysmal.
I haven't even seen it based on the poor critical reception it got. I was like, well, I won't waste my time. But there's a very fun movie in my head with cowboys and aliens in it, and I think I'll stick with that one.
It's called Wild Wild West.
No, it's not. And then he worked on Prometheus, the sort of the soft reboot for the Aliens franchise with Ridley Scott, right? Which a lot of the critical reaction for that movie centered around how, you know, it was much like Lost. It was unnecessarily vague. It had plot holes. It had an unsatisfying resolution.
Did you see that movie?
Prometheus? Yes. Yeah. I thought there was a lot to like about it. And what I think you can say about, well, there's a couple of things. One, Damon Lindelof is never the solo guy on any of this stuff, right? It's always a team. And you'll notice that even with World War Z, ultimately he brings in Drew Goddard, who was a guy who he worked with on Lost. And so, but on all of his films, so like Cowboys and Aliens has 9 screenwriting credits. Gene Roddenberry gets a screenwriting credit for the Star Trek movies, even the new ones, because he's the creator of the show. So some of those credits go to stuff like that and people like that with that kind of influence. But on Cowboys and Aliens, there were 5 actual writing credits, which means like those guys have words in the movie, or at least story elements or characters in the movie. With Prometheus, there were 4 credits and he was one of 2 writers. So you could say he had a big hand in Prometheus, you would think, but it's impossible to parse, right? And then on his latest credit, which is Star Trek Into Darkness, Star Trek 2 in the reboot, there's 4 credits and he's one of 3 writers. And then the other 2 writers are the guys who wrote the first one of the rebooted franchise. So he's never the only guy in the room. So it's really difficult to parse out what is Lindelof and purely Lindelof. But I don't want to slam Prometheus. I thought that it was far from a perfect movie, but the scene, and you know, spoilers for Prometheus, it's a couple of years old at this point. I feel I can talk about it. The scene where Nomi Rapace uses the automated surgery to abort the alien. Like that scene will live with me forever. Like that was a fantastic sci-fi horror scene. And I don't know who came up with that, But it was brilliant. It was brilliantly conceived. It was brilliantly executed, and it was no puns intended. And it was fantastic. And I read this Vanity Fair long piece about Lindelof's involvement and how it came to be in the movie after I saw the movie. Did you read it before seeing the movie?
I did. Yeah.
Okay. I wonder if that would affect things because.
But correct me if I'm wrong. It doesn't go into the details of the third act. That's something that I picked up somewhere else.
It definitely says that he's responsible for the ending, that the ending is new and that they had to go back.
The ending that they jettisoned.
Right. No, it does not go into the details of the ending that they jettisoned. There's some talk. It's supposed to be set in Russia. It's largely a battle scene.
Right.
That's about all the detail that you get. You had details, and this is something that you told me going into the movie, which totally affected me in the film, about the jettison storyline with Matthew Fox.
Right.
And I just felt so bad for Matthew Fox in that movie. I mean, Matthew Fox has a nice life, I'm sure, and lives in a nicer house than me. And I should not shed too many tears for Matthew Fox. But that's a guy who had like a decade of massive success on TV with Party of Five and then with Lost. And has now gone into movies and has made all of these plays like that seem on paper to be really smart plays to get himself out there. He did, Speed Racer with the Wachowskis. Where you're just like, okay, this is their follow-up to The Matrix. This is going to be awesome. And then it's not awesome. And then he did the movie with Tyler Perry, which was going to be a reboot of James Patterson's Cross franchise that Morgan Freeman had played Alex Cross in. And, and you're like, Tyler Perry, he's got the golden touch. He never makes a movie that's not a huge hit, except this one. And I felt particularly bad for Matthew Fox in that one because he plays I haven't seen it, but I've seen stills from it and scenes from it. And he plays the villain in the piece who's supposedly like a MMA serial killer. And so for the role, he's like, this guy is a mixed martial arts fighter. I am going to get ripped. I am going to get ultra ripped. I am going to have negative body fat. I'm going to like export body fat to needy people. And he obviously went through a huge De Niro-esque, Christian Bale-esque physical transformation, thinking that, that's going to be a talking point in the movie, right? Like, everybody's going to be talking about how great I am and what a transformation, and I'll talk about it on talk shows and blah, blah, blah. And, nobody goes to see that movie, right? And then he's like, well, at least I booked the Brad Pitt zombie movie. That's going to be huge. I'm going to have a big role in that. I'm going to be a big guy. If you didn't know that it was him, you wouldn't notice him in the film. He's like sixth billed and he doesn't even get a character name. He's paratrooper Matthew Fox. It is just a heartbreaking, heartbreaking moment. I feel so bad for the guy. Cause I know, like, I'm sure he did great work.
Okay. So what did you think of the ending of the movie?
It was the weakest part of the film, but only because I really, really enjoyed everything that came before that. And it sounds so vastly superior. And after reading the Vanity Fair article, I was like, well, what they did was so vastly superior to what they had previously done, or what it sounds like they had previously done, and so much more what I wanted from the film that the first two parts, were setting up.
Fair enough.
What did you think of it? Did you hate it? Did you love it?
Yeah, so there's a whiff of 28 Days Later in the hospital set piece. I don't know why. I don't know if it was because it was
Wales.
In Wales or whatever. but I was like, oh, okay. So we've brought the scope of this thing down to a closed room. A closed room situation where there's antagonists, there's boundaries, there's a time clock, the whole thing. This is a set piece that belongs in a different movie. I didn't dislike it, but in terms of scope and scale, I was like, oh, what a weird kind of bolt-on. And of course, when you know the story of the production, then it totally makes sense. But at the same time, I was like, yeah, all right, well, whatever.
I guess for me, I was fine with it, and I was fine with it as a change of pace because the first, there's some big, big pieces in this and they were fantastic. And I don't know where you go from there. Like, honestly, if they had just tried to do, you know, same again, but more, I feel that it would have failed. And I feel that from the sounds of things, again, I haven't seen this excised third act. It sounds like that's what they did try to do, you know, same again, but more. And it fell on its face.
Yeah.
So I almost like it. And but yes, again, you read the piece and you realize that a lot of their choices were being made out of not wanting to spend any more tens of millions of dollars and things like that.
So what did you think of the fast zombie, slow zombie thing that kind of sent the fanboys into a rage?
You know what? I don't have a Coke versus Pepsi dog in that fight. But I enjoyed the zombies in this movie. I thought they were suitably terrifying. I'm not now against slow zombies. I'm not now going to watch The Walking Dead and just be like, chumps.
So you said that it borrowed zero from the book, but they paid a little heed anyway to the geopolitical parts of the book.
And that
is one of the things that makes me love the book so much, right? So the fact that they kind of tip their hat without like totally taking a page, you know, verbatim dialogue out of the book, I thought was nicely done.
I think, no, absolutely. I'm so glad that that was the movie that they made, and it was a movie that we haven't seen in the zombie genre. So that was great. But it was a movie that you could have made, and the screenwriters, you know, could have, you know, been going around doing press or whatever, and people have been like, so where did you get the idea for like a global scale and the fast zombies? And they'd be like, oh, well, I read this great Max Brooks novel, World War Z, and it just opened my eyes to what zombies could be. Like it bore no, you know, it was inspired by.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not quite at the point where I would say Contagion was a better adaptation of the book. But I think, in some cases, anyways, Soderbergh clearly was carrying Brooks's water, you know, in some ways, and I missed that here, but I didn't hate it.
I feel that Soderbergh got those elements so much more, but what Mark Forster did, or what this screenplay did was, and this was something that you didn't get from the book because of how the book was set. This is not spoiling anything for the book. The book is set after the zombie war and looking back at the events of the zombie war. And what you get in this, and again, this is not spoilers for the movie because it happens in the first 5 minutes, is that sense of shocking and immediate collapse. That one moment it's the world as you know it, and the next moment it is just a completely different and more hellish world where the rules of civilization are changed out the window and you have to deal.
So I wouldn't describe it in those ways. It's like the inevitability that the zombies would win is like very clear in the book. Mm-hmm. And in every other zombie movie ever, you always have like the underdogs staging their last, you know, their last stand and you as an audience member are hoping for them, right? And in the book, there's no hope because it's fait accompli from page one, right?
Right.
And you know, fine. It would be very difficult, and apparently was, to bring that kind of thing to the screen, but that is definitely something that I missed. Okay, so let's move on because...
Absolutely.
Let's talk some books because we could talk about World War Z all day long.
That could be a whole show.
It could be.
I'm really curious because... So you're enthusiastic about Neil Gaiman's new book. And I would say that I am a fan of Gaiman. I was thinking back about books of his... How many books of his I've read, how many graphic novels of his that I've read, and so on and so forth. And I am definitely a fan of his, and yet I've never been completely 100% bowled over. I've been 75% bowled over or 80% bowled over. And yet those who, the Gaiman super fans, they love him. And not just because he's an incredibly charming internet presence, because he is. He, you know, there's a whole separate part of him, which is managing Neil Gaiman, the personality. And he's fantastic at it. But it sounds like this book has really, really got your engine running. And so I'm hoping, I'm hoping that you can bring me to Damascus here. I'm hoping that you can, you know, because I want to be where those people are. They seem so fucking happy.
Well, I think we've even talked about this on the show. Like, we're, I think, both on the record as being fans, but just not Uber fans, right?
Right.
And I think one of the earliest connections we had as friends was actually reading American Gods at the same time.
Ish, yes.
Yeah, so I have at least been spotty keeping up with him since then, actually. So
I have as well.
I probably own more Neil Gaiman than I've read.
Sure. I think that's true of every author in the canon for you, though.
Well, yes, possibly. So I've gone on a bit of a Gaiman binge this week, and I've kind of realized I've been missing out. So I cracked Ocean, right? And I was telling you about it, and then was saying, okay, well, we'll talk about it on the show. And after I finished it, and I haven't done this in years, but I immediately picked it up and started reading it again.
Really?
Yeah. So I read it twice.
You read the whole thing twice?
Well, it's only 180 pages.
Still?
Yeah. Read the whole thing twice. I then read the Graveyard Book from 2010.
Okay.
And then followed that up with Coraline. So I read Coraline, the Graveyard Book, and The Ocean at the End of the Lane.
And these are all books of his for notionally for younger readers.
Yeah, I would say that Coraline skews young. The Graveyard Book's probably middle grade, and Ocean is billed as a novel for adults, targeting adults, but it skews down to YA, I think.
Okay.
So yes. I think he wrote Anansi Boys in 2005, which was probably his last quote unquote adult novel.
Yeah, I guess it was. Wow, yeah. That's a big pause. I didn't realize it had been that long.
Yeah, so he's been on a bit of a skewing younger. So I thought that I would go back and cover this ground to get more context, right? So Ocean at the End of the Lane is clearly the best of the three. Yeah, it's not necessarily for kids, but it's probably his best book ever, maybe.
Bold.
At least of the last 15 years, right? So looking back over that coverage, I would say, yeah. Well, I haven't read Neverwhere and Stardust, so I couldn't say for sure, but definitely the best of the three. And looking at the fanboys rave online, it's seemingly captured something that none of the previous books have. So, as you know, right, his strength is the conceit, the imaginative construct, right? And he's clever and ingenious in his world building and all that stuff. And he kind of reminds me of Paul Auster in this way, in that his storytelling for me has gone flat. In the past, like he'll build up this world and then
the air slowly leaks out.
Yeah, yeah, and that doesn't happen this time at all. And that might be because of the thinness of the story, or if he's just on his game or whatever. But it's a fantasy, I guess, in the strictest sense. But it kind of approaches the kind of classic fairy tale or myth in the way it's kind of delivered. If that makes sense.
Can you give me the hook for this? Like, what's the setup?
Yeah. So it starts with a young boy, unnamed, age 7. He's in Sussex, England, and he has a birthday party, and no one shows up.
Mm.
So he's left with his mother to have, you know, she lights the candles all by himself. So he says that no one shows up. He says he has no friends and is left at that. And he loves books, and there's a book on the top of the cake. He has a cat, a sister, a mother, a father. And then the family kind of is on hard times, I guess. They've had dipping fortune. So they start taking in lodgers. And so he's kicked well, not kicked out of his bedroom, but he then is moved in to his sister's room, and they are sharing a bedroom, and his old bed is given up to billeters who are, you know, in and out of the house. So one lodger on the day of his arrival kills his cat. The taxi cab runs over his kitty cat. Okay. And then unrelated, ends up dying himself a few days later. And then from there, the whole story goes into the fantastical. Right. So, so when it actually took me, on the second read, I was like, oh, this is where the break is. Right. Cause I was so caught up in the story and the momentum of the tale that I wasn't really paying attention to the structure, but going back, I was like, oh, okay. So, right.
Gotcha.
It kind of spins out and spins back and, you know, the magic starts there kind of thing. And it's gorgeously written. Oh, it's so, so gorgeous. The writing is brilliant. So after the death of the lodger, kind of what happens next?
Well, do you want to say any more? Because I'm, from a plot point of view, I mean, the image of the young boy and nobody shows up to his birthday party, like that is so potently sad. And then I get the sense of what this is, I think. And if you can get away with saying no more about the plot, I would be fine with what you've given me.
Right. So, yeah. Well, so what happens next, it doesn't really make it a kid story, and it doesn't really make it an adult story either way.
Okay.
So, like, you know, some bad stuff happens after that. Yeah. But it's more like it really reminded me more of like a fairy tale from the 1800s, right?
Okay.
In that it was not appropriately a childish book, but not an adult book either, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he's a small child in a big person's world with fears and cruelty and an imagination kind of just as big, right? To match, if that makes sense.
The world doesn't sort of take doesn't go to any great lengths to make allowances for the fact that he's a child.
Well, you know, he punches above his weight in terms of what he brings to the story at that point, right?
Interesting.
So, you know, if you've read any Gaiman at all, I think that from that setup, you recognize that it's essentially that's what Gaiman does. So in like a very compact 180 pages, you're basically mainlining like Gaiman's whole oeuvre, right? Like it's like the crack cocaine of Gaiman concentrated all in one story, if that makes sense.
Which is kind of almost exactly what I want to hear, because my experience of him is I'm more familiar with his early works. I've read, you know, this is something that very few people will have read, largely because it's tied up in litigation. But there was a comic series called Marvel Man, published as Miracle Man in the U.S., which Alan Moore wrote for a while and then handpicked Gaiman to be his successor on the title. And Gaiman wrote a series of vignette stories. So all like, you know, 22 pages and out, and each one was incredibly different from the next. You know, we're talking about a subterranean hell filled with characters, all of whom look like Andy Warhol, or, you know, a fairy story, or I don't want to spoil them, but they're, cause who knows, maybe that litigation will be resolved and they'll come back in print. I highly recommend that people check them out, but they're all incredibly contained. He's working within such constraints, and they're so satisfying, I think, because of that. And his the early parts of the Sandman series, where he's writing himself out of the constraints imposed upon him by the remit of the series. There is some stuff in there which, you know, because it starts out as almost a straight horror series, because that's what was wanted, a straight horror series set in the wider DC universe. And he sort of, he writes his way out of that like it's a straitjacket, and in doing so does some incredibly terrifying and wonderful genre work. And so, you know, the Good Omens novel that he co-wrote with Terry Pratchett is one that I constantly recommend to people. And I think the, you know, the constraint of working in a comedic vein served him well. So I like him when he's in a bit of a straitjacket.
I was going to say, like, people that don't like him, because this is him in concentrated form, will really hate this, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So it's like, yeah, particularly like the Lewis Carroll elements that he draws on. Like, if you find that to be too gauche or whatever, then you'll... well, not too gauche. If you find that to be too constructed, is the word, is kind of the idea I'm going for, then you'll hate this. So this is not... This is a genre piece, very, you know, fantasy-driven, but of a tradition, of a fairy tale tradition. So if that, you know, if that scares you away, that scares you away. But I loved it, right? So I know you are a big fan of Mark Haddon's The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
Very much so.
And I would say all the fans of that book need to read this. But to compare them, you know, you as a reader of that, of Curious Night, are really omniscient. You know, you really know what's going on outside of the voice of the narrator.
Sure.
In this, you really are seeing the world through the eyes of the 7-year-old. So there's no omniscience, if that makes sense.
So how was that second read then? Was there a whole new layer of pleasures in this for you the second time around?
There was, yeah, because it's so... So he refines his imagery so well. It's just a beautifully written prose story. So yeah, no, it paid off the second time for sure. I really think that it's him at the pinnacle of his craft, and that's probably all I have to say. So that's my pick for the week.
Dude, you hit that mega hard. I'm gonna have to read this now. It's like there's no ifs, ands, or buts.
And you can on, you know, you can in very short time, because you'll blast through it in a sitting or two.
Even better. It's like the opposite of food. It's fantastic. And there's so little.
Yeah. And if there's any fans of the Graveyard Book, those adults that read the Graveyard Book and fell in love with it, have to check this out as well. But they probably will without any prodding from us.
Do you need to read Coraline or the Graveyard Book prior to this? Is there any benefit to that, or is it a straight up standalone? Check it out.
It is a straight up standalone. It's something that, like, there are parallels between this and Graveyard. None of the characters are the same, I'll say. But you can see the germ of certain things ripen from Graveyard pay off here. I'm not just saying that because I read them adjacently, but, you know, in the press, when he won the Newbery for Graveyard Book, he talked about how he was like, had this idea for Graveyard Book in his mind for a long time and never thought he was a good enough writer to pull off a kid's story about a kid whose parents are killed and grows up in a graveyard, right? And then he was just like, no, I'm just going to sit down and do it. And the first chapter he wrote of that book is not the first chapter in the story itself. It's a story where two characters meet, and you kind of have a repeat of that meeting in Ocean. But of course, it's better and more filled out, right? So I, you know, one of the things that I think that Gaiman has been reluctant doing over his career, or over the career that I've read anyway, is he's, you know, kind of reluctant to talk about England. He's and reluctant to talk about himself. So this is like personal, but not autobiographical. And I think that the more personal he gets, the better he gets. Because he really brushes up against some really heavy, important stuff, but it never has the weight to it, I feel. And this is a personal story in a way that I haven't seen him write any other place.
I think you're right about that. I think that he is a man who has had a bad birthday in his life, because there's a bad birthday in one of the graphic novels that he did with Dave McKean. It's like not a Sandman graphic novel. It's a standalone. I think, and although it's been literally decades since I read it, I think it's Violent Cases. So maybe there's even more of Gaiman in here than he will admit to.
Definitely. And I can't possibly say more without ruining it. There is like some moments in here where you're just like, oh, like that just cuts the bone. That is real heavy personal stuff. You know, in whatever guise, right? And like, there's no fantasy, there's no magic, there's no whimsy about any of that stuff. It's like, it's real kind of adult, human, grown up, heavy stuff.
All right. Well, that is it for another episode of the Enthusiasticast. We welcome your suggestions for books that you're enthusiastic about. We always love to hear from you, and you can reach us at email hello@enthusiasticast.com. Until next time, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers. Thank you. Very nice. But first, John, we were unanimous. We were in you. La, la, la. But stop laughing.